Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Now mai haere mai. I'm John McDonald, kia ora, and welcome into the Hut Zone on Thursday the 8th of June. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, history, people, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight, there's more in our history series with former Petone Mayor Annie Huggin talking with Jenny Forsyth. It was recorded in 1979 and shared with us by Hutt City Library's Heritage Centre. Tonight we hear about Mrs. Huggin's move from Korokoro down to Petone and entering local politics. We finish hearing Catherine Mansfield's story Bliss, read by Jennifer March from her YouTube channel, Not Your Mother's Storytime. There's Upper Hutt military history from the research of the New Zealand Remembrance Army on the World War service of Private William Lindsay from Mangaroa Valley. And we have local music from Upper Hutt's The Formula, She's A, and from King Leo, Lord, I Gotta Win One. So let's start the show with some poetry from Eastbourne.
The Unknown Mother of Icarus by Emmanuel E. Garcia. She saw it. She was at the window despite herself. The billow above the chop of the windswept harbor, not much higher than a wave, but more definitive, a small tear of its skin that healed no sooner than the cleft. Swallowing the urge to retch, she dressed, not in haste. There was no need for haste. She knew where to go. It would take an hour or two. No need to rush. As she lingered at her mirror, checking, the beauty of the day wasn't lost on her. It wasn't long before she reached the spot where the currents converged, where the waters always brought them in a little less violently because of the sheltering rock. When it washed up, the body was intact and limp, easier to heft into her lap. From their niche, she scanned the unwrought emptiness above the sky and marked the height of the sun by the beat of her brine-soaked lips, not grieving.
And that was The Unknown Mother of Icarus by Eastbourne's Emmanuel E. Garcia. Let's stay in Eastbourne for our reading of the week, part two of Catherine Mansfield's short story, Bliss. A recap from last week. Bertha Young, a 30-year-old wife and mother, enjoys a comfortable middle-class life with her husband Harry and their baby, though Nanny seems to be very protective of the baby. Bertha passes her days in an almost delirious state of happiness and contentment, and we begin to wonder how a person can possibly sustain this level of unbridled joy. Bertha and Harry are having a party, and the guests of the dinner party have just started to arrive.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. And now, Bliss by Catherine Mansfield. A white dress, a string of jade beads, green shoes and stockings. It wasn't intentional. She had thought of this scheme hours before she stood at the drawing room window. Her petals rustled softly into the hall, and she kissed Mrs. Norman Knight, who was taking off the most amusing orange coat with a procession of black monkeys round the hem and up the fronts.
Why is the middle class so stodgy, so utterly without a sense of humour? My dear, it's only by a fluke that I'm here at all, Norman being the protective fluke. For my darling monkeys so upset the train that it rose to a man and simply ate me with its eyes. Didn't laugh, wasn't amused, that I should have loved. No, just stared and bored me through and through.
But the cream of it was,
said Norman, pressing a large tortoiseshell-rimmed monocle to his eye.
You don't mind me telling this face, do you?
In their home and among their friends, they called each other Face and Mug.
The cream of it was when she, being full-fed, turned to the woman beside her and said, Haven't you ever seen a monkey before?
Oh, yes, Mrs. Norman Knight joined in the laughter.
Wasn't that too absolutely creamy?
And a funnier thing still was that now her coat was off, and she did look like a very intelligent monkey who had even made that yellow silk dress out of scraped banana skins, and her amber earrings, they were like little dangling nuts.
This is a sad, sad fall,
said Mug, pausing in front of Little Bee's perambulator.
When the perambulator comes into the hall.
And he waved the rest of the quotation away. The bell rang. It was lean, pale Eddie Warren, as usual, in a state of acute distress.
It is the right house, isn't it?
He pleaded. Oh, I think so. I hope so, said Bertha, brightly.
I have had such a dreadful experience with the taxi man. He was most sinister. I couldn't get him to stop. The more I knocked and called, the faster he went. And in the moonlight, this bizarre figure with a flattened head crouching over the little wheel.
He shuddered, taking off an immense white silk scarf. Bertha noticed that his socks were white, too. Most charming.
But how dreadful, she cried.
Yes, it really was, said Eddie, following her into the drawing room. I saw myself driving through eternity in a timeless taxi.
He knew the Norman Knights. In fact, he was going to write a play for N.K. when the theater scheme came off.
Well, Warren, how's the play?
Said Norman Knight, dropping his monocle and giving his eye a moment in which to rise to the surface before it was screwed down again. And Mrs. Norman Knight.
Oh, Mr. Warren, what happy socks! I'm so glad you like them, he said, staring at his feet. They seem to have got so much whiter since the moon rose.
And he turned his lean, sorrowful young face to Bertha.
There is a moon, you know.
She wanted to cry. I am sure there is. Often, often. He really was the most attractive person, but so was Face, crouched before the fire in her banana skins, and so was Mug, smoking a cigarette, and saying as he flicked the ashes,
Why doth the bridegroom tarry?
There he is now. Bang went the front door open and shut. Harry shouted,
Hello, people. Down in 5 minutes.
And they heard him swarm up the stairs. Bertha couldn't help smiling. She knew how he loved doing things at high pressure. What, after all, did an extra 5 minutes matter? But he would pretend to himself that they mattered beyond measure, and then he would make a great point of coming into the drawing room extravagantly cool and collected. Harry had such a zest for life. Oh, how she appreciated it in him, and his passion for fighting, for seeking in everything that came up against him another test of his power and of his courage. That, too, she understood, even when it made him just occasionally to other people who didn't know him well, a little ridiculous, perhaps, for there were moments when he rushed into battle where no battle was. She talked and laughed and positively forgot, until he came in, just as she had imagined, that Pearl Fulton had not turned up. I wonder if Miss Fulton has forgotten.
I expect so, said Harry. Is she on the phone?
Ah, there's a taxi now. And Bertha smiled with that little air of proprietorship that she always assumed while her women finds were new and mysterious. She lives in taxis.
She'll run to fat if she does, said Harry coolly, ringing the bell for dinner. Frightful danger for blonde women.
Harry, don't, warned Bertha, laughing up at him. Came another tiny moment while they waited, laughing and talking, just a trifle too much at their ease, a trifle too unaware. And then Miss Fulton, all in silver, with a silver fillet binding her pale blonde hair, came in smiling, her head a little on one side.
Am I late?
No, not at all, said Bertha. Come along.
and she took her arm and they moved into the dining room. What was there in the touch of that cool arm that could fan, start blazing, the fire of bliss that Bertha did not know what to do with? Miss Fulton did not look at her, but then she seldom did look at people directly. Her heavy eyelids lay upon her eyes, and the strange half-smile came and went upon her lips, as though she lived by listening rather than seeing. But Bertha knew suddenly, as if the longest, most intimate look had passed between them, as if they had said to each other, "You two?" that Pearl Fulton, stirring the beautiful red soup in the gray plate, was feeling just what she was feeling. And the others? Face and mug, Eddie and Harry, their spoons rising and falling, dabbing their lips with their napkins, crumbling bread, fiddling with the forks and glasses, and talking.
"I met her at the Alpha Show, the weirdest little person. She'd not only cut off her hair, but she seemed to have taken a dreadfully good snip off her legs and arms, and her neck and her poor little nose as well.
Isn't she very in liege with Michael Oates? The man who wrote Love and False Teeth? He wants to write a play for me, one act, one man. Decides to commit suicide, gives all the reasons why he should and why he shouldn't, and just as he has made up his mind either to do it or not to do it, curtain. Not half a bad idea. What's he going to call it? Stomach trouble? I think I've come across the same idea in a little French review, quite unknown in England."
No, they didn't share it. They were dears, dears, and she loved having them there at her table and giving them delicious food and wine. In fact, she longed to tell them how delightful they were and what a decorative group they made, how they seemed to set one another off, and how they reminded her of a play by Chekhov. Harry was enjoying his dinner. It was part of his, well, not his nature exactly, and certainly not his pose, his something or other, to talk about food and to glory in on his shameless passion for the white flesh of the lobster and the green pistachio ices, green and cold like the eyelids of Egyptian dancers. When he looked up at her and said,
"Bertha, this is a very admirable soufflé,"
she almost could have wept with childlike pleasure. Oh, why did she feel so tender towards the whole world tonight? Everything was good, was right. All that happened seemed to fill again her brimming cup of bliss. And still, in the back of her mind, there was the pear tree. It would be silver now in the light of poor dear Eddie's moon, silver as Miss Fulton, who sat there turning a tangerine in her slender fingers that were so pale a light seemed to come from them. What she simply couldn't make out, what was miraculous, was how she should have guessed Miss Fulton's mood so exactly and so instantly, for she never doubted for a moment that she was right, and yet what had she to go on? Less than nothing. I believe this does happen very, very rarely between women, never between men, thought Bertha. But while I'm making the coffee in the drawing-room, perhaps she will give a sign. What she meant by that she did not know, and what would happen after that she could not imagine. While she thought like this, she saw herself talking and laughing. She had to talk because of her desire to laugh. I must laugh or die. But when she noticed Face's funny little habit of tucking something down the front of her bodice, as if she'd kept a tiny secret hoard of nuts there, too, Bertha had to dig her nails into her hands so as not to laugh too much. It was over at last, and "Come and see my new coffee machine," said Bertha.
"We only have a new coffee machine once a fortnight," said Harry.
Face took her arm this time. Miss Fulton bent her head and followed after. The fire had died down in the drawing-room to a red, flickering
"nest of baby phoenixes," said Face.
"Don't turn up the light for a moment. It is so lovely." And down she crouched by the fire again. She was always cold. Without her little red flannel jacket, of course, thought Bertha. At that moment, Miss Fulton gave the sign.
"Have you a garden?" said the cool, sleepy voice.
This was so exquisite on her part that all Bertha could do was to obey. She crossed the room, pulled the curtains apart and opened the long windows. "There," she breathed. And the two women stood side by side, looking at the slender flowering tree. Although it was so still, it seemed like the flame of a candle to stretch up, to point, to quiver in the bright air, to grow taller and taller as they gazed, almost to touch the rim of the round silver moon. How long did they stand there, both, as it were, caught in that circle of unearthly light, understanding each other perfectly, creatures of another world, and wondering what they were to do in this one with all this blissful treasure that burned in their bosoms and dropped in silver flowers from their hair and hands. Forever, for a moment. And did Miss Fulton murmur, "Yes, just that"? Or did Bertha dream it? Then the light was snapped on, and Face made the coffee, and Harry said, "My dear Mrs. Knight, don't ask me about my baby. I never see her. I shan't feel the slightest interest in her until she has a lover." And Mug took his eye out of the conservatory for a moment, and then put it under glass again, and Eddie Warren drank his coffee, and set down the cup with a face of anguish, as though he had drunk and seen the spider.
"What I want to do is give the young men a show. I believe London is simply teeming with first-chop unwritten plays. What I want to say to him is, here's the theatre, fire ahead."
"You know, my dear, I'm going to decorate a room for the Jacob Nathans. Oh, I'm so tempted to do a fried fish scheme, with the backs of the chairs shaped like frying pans, and lovely chip potatoes embroidered all over the curtains."
"The trouble with our young writing men is that they're still too romantic. You can't put out to sea without being seasick and wanting a basin. Well, why don't they have the courage of those basins?"
"A dreadful poem about a girl who was violated by a beggar without a nose in a little wood."
Miss Fulton sank into the lowest, deepest chair, and Harry handed round the cigarettes. From the way he stood in front of her, shaking the silver box and saying abruptly,
"Egyptian, Turkish, Virginian, they're all mixed up,"
Bertha realized that she not only bored him, he really disliked her, and she decided from the way Miss Fulton said, "No, thank you, I won't smoke," that she felt it too and was hurt. "Oh, Harry, don't dislike her. You are quite wrong about her. She's wonderful, wonderful. And besides, how can you feel so differently about someone who means so much to me? I shall try to tell you, when we are in bed tonight, what has been happening, what she and I have shared." At those last words, something strange and almost terrifying darted into Bertha's mind, and this something, blind and smiling, whispered to her, "Soon these people will go. The house will be quiet. Quiet! The lights will be out, and you and he will be alone together in the dark room, the warm bed." She jumped from her chair and ran over to the piano. "What a pity someone does not play!" she cried. "What a pity somebody does not play!" For the first time in her life, Bertha Young desired her husband. Oh, she loved him. She'd been in love with him, of course, in every other way, but just not in that way. And equally, of course, she understood that he was different. They discussed it so often. It had worried her dreadfully at first to find that she was so cold, but after a time it had not seemed to matter. They were so frank with each other, such good pals. That was the best of being modern. But now, ardently, ardently, the word ached in her ardent body. Was this what that feeling of bliss had been leading up to? But then...
"My dear," said Mrs. Norman Knight, "you know our shame. We are the victims of time and train. We live in Hampstead. It's been so nice."
"I'll come with you into the hall," said Bertha. "I loved having you, but you must not miss the last train. That's so awful, isn't it?"
"Have a whiskey, Knight, before you go," called Harry.
"No thanks, old chap."
Bertha squeezed his hand for that, as she shook it. "Good night, goodbye," she cried from the top step, feeling that this self of hers was taking leave of them forever. When she got back into the drawing room, the others were on the move. "Then you can come part of the way in my taxi."
"I shall be so thankful not to have to face another drive alone after my dreadful experience."
"You can get a taxi at the rank just at the end of the street. You won't have to walk more than a few yards."
"That's a comfort. I'll go and put on my coat." Miss Fulton moved towards the hall, and Bertha was following when Harry almost pushed past.
"Let me help you."
Bertha knew that he was repenting his rudeness. She let him go. What a boy he was in some ways, so impulsive, so simple. And Eddie and she were left by the fire.
"I wonder if you have seen Bilk's new poem called Table d'Hôte," said Eddie softly. "It's so wonderful, in the last anthology. Have you got a copy? I'd so like to show it to you. It begins with an incredibly beautiful line. Why must it always be tomato soup?"
"Yes," said Bertha. And she moved noiselessly to a table opposite the drawing-room door, and Eddie glided noiselessly after her. She picked up the little book and gave it to him. They had not made a sound. While he looked it up, she turned her head towards the hall, and she saw Harry with Miss Fulton's coat in his arms, and Miss Fulton with her back turned to him and her head bent. He tossed the coat away, put his hands on her shoulders, and turned her violently to him. His lips said, "I adore you." And Miss Fulton laid her moonbeam fingers on his cheeks and smiled her sleepy smile. Harry's nostrils quivered, his lips curled back in a hideous grin, while he whispered, "Tomorrow." And with her eyelids, Miss Fulton said, "Yes."
"Here it is," said Eddie.
"Why must it always be tomato soup? It's so deeply true, don't you feel? Tomato soup is so dreadfully eternal."
"If you prefer," said Harry's voice, very loud from the hall, "I can phone you a cab to come to the door."
"Oh, no, it's not necessary," said Miss Fulton, and she came up to Bertha and gave her the slender fingers to hold. "Goodbye. Thank you so much."
"Goodbye," said Bertha. Miss Fulton held her hand a moment longer.
"Your lovely pear tree," she murmured. And then she was gone, with Eddie following, like the black cat following the gray cat.
"I'll shut up shop,"
said Harry, extravagantly cool and collected.
"Your lovely pear tree, pear tree, pear tree."
Bertha simply ran over to the long windows.
"Oh, what is going to happen now?" she cried. But the pear tree was as lovely as ever, and as full of flower, and as still.
Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.
I'm John MacDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was Catherine Mansfield's Bliss, read by Jennifer March from her YouTube channel, Not Your Mother's Storytime. Okay, time for some music. From former Upper Hutt band The Formula, here's She's A.
You can see her on the corners. You can see her at the fair. You can see her, you can see her anywhere. I can see without a reservation. She's the one to raise your expectation. There is only one small complication. She's a she can take you where there's always action. And I know she'll give you satisfaction. She's a girl in a half, she's always good for a laugh. And when you see her, you know what I mean. Well, a diddly dee da 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 dee da bop, a bop bop doo da doo da diddly dum, a dee dee da 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 ba dum, diddly dum dum dum, bang da da dee da da diddly dum, a doo doo da 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 dum, da 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 dum da 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 da. I can say without a reservation, it's the one to raise your expectation. There is only one small complication. She's a she can take you where there's always action, and I know she'll give you satisfaction. She's a girl in her arms, she's always good for a laugh, but when you see her, you know what I mean. Well, a deedly dee da 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 da.
And that was The Formula, and She's A. Next up, we hear part four in our 1979 history series from the archives of Hutt City Library's Heritage Centre, when former Petone Mayor Annie Huggan talked with Jenny Forsyth.
Did Mr. Huggins' father live, Mr. Huggins Senior, live in Corocoro too?
Yes, Joe and his father, they built a cottage, which I was told just the other day is going to be pulled down. They built the cottage so that his mother and father could live there, in the cottage, on the property.
Where was that? Where well, is it?
You've seen the shop.
Yes.
Well, you've got to go through. I don't know, it's all altered. But it's right at the far end.
Oh, the little one on the little one. Carved out on a ledge. Yes.
But it was a dear little cottage. Mm. It had a sun porch and a bedroom and a big-sized kitchen. And, of course, the toilet facilities in those days were an outside toilet.
That's right.
Which used to give me the horrors. I was scared to death to go out. But I always remember Aunt Daisy coming up there and sitting in that toilet, and then telling me it was the first time she'd been in a toilet with a view. Because there's a beautiful view all over Wellington.
Was Aunt Daisy a friend?
Aunt Daisy was the one. Aunt Daisy on
the
TV.
Aunt Daisy.
The Aunt Daisy.
Yes. Mrs. Basham.
Daisy Basham. Yes. Daisy Basham. And we used to, buses used to come up to Corocoro, and we served afternoon teas. And the day that Aunt Daisy came up, four buses came. We sold out everything in the shop, chocolates and ice cream and everything. And Aunt Daisy made quite certain that everybody that came in for afternoon tea paid, because she went round with a saucer and collected the ninepence, which was ninepence for the cup of tea and as much to eat of homemade biscuits and cake that they wanted.
Where did you serve it?
We served them everywhere. We served them in the kitchen, we served them outside, we served them sat on the bed.
Was Aunt Daisy doing her session from there?
No, she wasn't. She came up for the ride.
Oh.
And then she wanted to go out to the toilet, so we showed her where the toilet was, and then she came back, and that's what she said. She said, well, you know, it's the first time I've been in a toilet with a view.
And you chose to go to Corocoro because it was a nice place, not for farming or...
Oh, no. We just had a wee cottage when we went there, when Joe and I went there. But Joe and his mother, and then his auntie, all that land around there belonged to us. There was 4.5 acres. There was more. There was over 4.5 acres. 4.5 acres was a lot of land in that time.
Is that running down into the
and
bush garden?
Now there's houses built all the way around it. Oh, it was a lovely place. It was lovely there. We loved Corocoro. I think it's the only time I felt... I used to think when people said they were homesick for a place, I thought you could be homesick for people and your home. But for just a place, you couldn't be homesick for a place, but by Jove you can. When we came down here, we'd left Corocoro. I was homesick. I was ill for a while, And Mrs. Fleet used to come down every day because Joe was at work, you see, down at the council. And she would come down here and she would stay here with me. And as she came in, it was like a breath of Karakara. And I used to say, oh, Mary, this is so lovely. And Roger Baker was our doctor. And I had pneumonia, and he came and he closed all the windows. And I said, you wouldn't have done that if I'd been on Karakara. Of course, he'd have had to close the windows just the same, but I was sure he wouldn't.
Did you come down here when Joe became mayor?
No, after. We had to make up our minds. It was a case of we bought a house down here. We had this house empty for 9 months before we came to live in it. And, Joe was very ill part of the time. It was a case of we had to decide, would we sell the shop? Would we come and live in Peterney? Would I give up my darling? What would happen? Because you couldn't do the whole lot and still Joe remain mayor and go up and down to Karakara. It was real hard work. We talked about it and we talked about it, and then one day Joe said to me, well, we'll buy a house in Peterney for a start. And I saw an advertisement in the paper, and the man that sold us this house turned out that he was the best man at my nephew's wedding. It was rather strange. And he came and picked Joe and I up, and we came and had a look at it. It was empty. We didn't realize until after we bought it there wasn't a cupboard in the place except one. And the whole place, no wardrobes, nothing, but the house itself. As a lad from Karakara said to me the first time he came down, he said, Lusty, this is a friendly house. And it's always been a friendly house. We saw it, and Joe fell in love with it, said, we'll buy it. And he signed the papers whilst he was in hospital, because then we didn't come to live in it for 9 months. Because it was a case then of selling the shop, you see, getting rid of the business up there. But my uncle used to come down here and look after the garden. And that was another rather funny thing, because there was a telephone in, but you could only ring, I think Uncle could ring to us at Karakara, or we could ring to him down here, but you couldn't ring both ways. You couldn't. And I kept saying to Joe, wish you'd get in touch with the post office and tell them that we do want the telephone. Oh, we said, plenty of time for that. And as I tell you, in 9 months we didn't come down here. We used to come down. We came down here and we entertained in the house when it was the Central School 75th Jubilee celebrations. And quite a lot of the people came here, Mr. George G, and I've still got a bottle of Chinese whiskey that he brought. And all the MPs were there, Mr. Moore and Mr. Kent and quite a lot of the others, and they all came round here that night. And then, of course, we went home to bed. And we were coming in here on the Saturday, and on the Thursday, a man came into the shop at Karakara, and he said, Mistress Huggin, can I have the keys to 73? I said, what on earth do you want the keys to 73 for? He said, I'm going to go and take the telephone out. I said, you can't do that. I said, we're going in there on Saturday, and we will want the telephone. He said, I'm sorry, but we have to take it out. Because one could have said to Joe, I told you so, but I didn't. I just simply told him, I said, we're losing the telephone. He said, oh, it's lovely. Nobody can worry us. We wished we had the telephone because we didn't have one for 6 weeks. And that meant that when the council wanted Joe, they had to send somebody round for him. When I wanted to get in touch with the people I was doing work for, I had to go next door to either the butcher or the grocer's shop and ask if I might use their telephone. And this went on for 6 weeks, when we got the telephone back again.
Your husband was a councillor, wasn't he, before he was mayor?
Yes, for approximately almost 20 years before he became mayor. And also, he was 3 times he tried to get on the power board before he became, on the power board. He was three times he had to try. Although he topped the poll at the council every time, he couldn't get on the power board for some reason or other, but eventually he did. And then it was quite funny at the elections. I remember sitting there, and a person who is now dead, she was a wonderful old lady, very strong, Labour principles, And she touched me on the shoulder. She said, come on, that's the man you want to back for. Yeah, that's the man you want to back for, vote for. That's Joe Hogan, you know. You vote for him. He's the man. You vote for Joe Hogan. So I turned around and I looked at her. I said, well, I happen to be Mrs. Hogan. So I said, I think I will be voting for him. Oh, lovely, lovely, you know. And that was the year he did get in as mayor. And he was mayor for 7 years. And I was mayor for 8 years. That was 15 years I did as mayor and mayoress, which was rather wonderful. And it was wonderful.
This was the heyday of the Labour councils, wasn't it?
Definitely. Yes. There's no question about that. Mm. It was. And when Joe died, this was a most remarkable thing, because I had never even thought about the idea of the probability of becoming mayor. I'd always helped Joe in whatever he wanted to do, and I never asked questions, because he always said that he didn't tell me, because what you didn't know, you couldn't tell anybody else. And
very
if he
wise.
Had anything to discuss, it definitely was not council matters. He would come home from a council meeting, he would have a cup of tea and probably a drink of beer, and if he came in looking very happy and contented with the world in general, I knew that the meeting had been good. But if he looked a bit despondent, I knew that things had gone not just as he would have liked them to go. But he was very popular down at the council. I never only saw him in the council chambers, actually in the mayoral seat, twice during the time he was mayor. And that was when it was the Christmas party, which they always had a wonderful time at their Christmas parties in the Pitonibarra council chambers. And when he died, rather tragically, I was asked if I would stand for the mayoralty. I had exactly 1 week to make up my mind. Joe died on the Friday, and he was buried on the Monday, and I had to make up my mind by the Sunday if I would accept. I sent for my solicitor, and he said the decision will have to be yours. I sent for my minister, he told me the same thing. I sent for Sam Lang, and Sam said, my dear, he said, whichever your choice is, I will be right behind you. And Sam was right behind me the whole of the time I was mayor. He said, if you do not accept the position, I'll still be there to help you in any way. And on the Saturday morning, the minister was doing my lawns outside, and a telegram came from Joe's sister, which simply said, you will make the right decision. Well, it's quite a decision to have to make.
Enormous.
And having only that short time, and on the Sunday night, I didn't go down to the Labour Party. They were holding a meeting where I'd had to say whether I would accept or not. And they came here after the meeting, all the chaps, it was a Labour Council at that time, and they came and they stood here. And they brought drinks with them, and they stood here, and they put their drinks up like that, and they said, she's going to do it, God bless her, we'll look after her. And I never regretted it. I had my sad moments, I had my moments when, as a matter of fact, Nora Gregor would be the person who could tell you, when I stood against Trevor Dick the night before, a different council then, you see, and when I stood against Trevor Dick, that was my last time standing, the night before the breakup. I don't know what they do today, I've got no idea, but always Joe had done this. The night before the breakup, before the elections, you were asked them all to come and join you in a little get-together, and that kind of thing. But this night I couldn't do it, and I stood up and I said, well, gentlemen, I've taken the utmost disrespect from you all for the last 3 years. Good night.
Who was that? Not your own council?
No, no. It was the opposition. And I went into my office and cried. And the only one, everyone went away without saying good night. The only one that stayed behind was Trevor Dick. And then Trevor came to talk to me, and I said, Trevor, you may be the best administrator in the world, but if you haven't got your council with you, you're not going to get anywhere. Remember that. And Trevor, then, when the elections came, on the election day, all Trevor's friends, who should have been standing beside him, stood looking in at the library windows with their noses on the window. And when they saw the figures going mounting up for me and going down for Trevor, they gradually walked away. Not one of them came in to shake his hand. And then Trevor made one of the nicest speeches I think I've heard, in which he finished up by saying that he felt that the administration of the borough could not be in better hands than the hands of the previous mayor, which was rather lovely, I thought.
I'm Jim McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was the late Jenny Forsyth talking with the late Annie Huggin in 1979 on Mrs. Huggin's memories of Petone and Korokoro. Thank you to Hutt Library's Heritage Centre for letting us play that interview. Part 5 plays next week. Time for more history, but this time from the top of the Hutt Valley.
Folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
From the research of the Upper Hutt War Stories NZ Remembrance Army, Private William Alfred Lindsay, 63624. A fading headstone in the Wallaceville Cemetery plays tribute to a loving couple who raised their family in Upper Hutt. The New Zealand Remembrance Army in 2021 cleaned and restored the headstone in honour of a brave First World War soldier. Born in Kilburnie, Wellington, Will Lindsay was raised on the Miramar Peninsula, where his father worked as a dairyman. Will helped out on the farm in between his school studies. The young teenager moved with his family to Upper Hutt just before World War I. The family had purchased a farm in the Mangaroa Valley. Will was too young to enlist in the New Zealand Expeditionary Force right away. Like many young men, he had undertaken compulsory military training and was serving with the local Territorial Infantry Regiment. It wasn't until the 16th of May 1917 that Will was able to undergo a medical examination and a test at the Wellington Town Hall. Expressing an interest in service with the New Zealand Artillery on enlistment, he was instead posted to H Company 31st Reinforcement as a rifleman. He marched into Trentham Camp on the 22nd of August. 2 weeks later, he was transferred to the 32nd Reinforcements at Featherston and placed in F Company, which provided reserves for the Canterbury Infantry Regiment. After 3 months of rigorous training, Will boarded His Majesty's New Zealand Transport Maunganui, HMNZT 96, and sailed for the United Kingdom. Disembarking at Liverpool a week after New Year's Day 1918, he proceeded to Sling Camp, where he underwent further training as a member of the Canterbury Regiment Reserve Battalion. Finally shipped off to France in early May 1918, Will found himself posted to No. 2 New Zealand Entrenching Battalion, formed largely from the now disbanded 4th New Zealand Infantry Brigade. All new arrivals within the New Zealand Division were posted to one of these three units until called forward into a frontline battalion. Will spent 2 months working alongside many other new arrivals as the Kiwis prepared for their part in the last major offensive of the war. He worked in the entrenching battalion, behind the lines, digging trenches, burying communication wires, carrying stores to forward locations, and guarding key points around Heybutern. On the 13th of July 1918, Will was finally called forward into the 2nd Canterbury Infantry Battalion. Posted into the 13th North Canterbury and Westland Company of the unit, he had just 5 weeks to learn the ropes before taking part in his first major attack. With his company leading on the left, they pushed forward at 8:30 a.m. on the morning of the 24th of August towards Bivouac. Moving in lines of sections, the numerous small groups each moved in single file over open and gently rolling terrain behind a screen of light and heavy tanks. They were met by a heavy enemy artillery barrage, but managed to push forward and secure a line east of the town on the outskirts of Bapaume. Will and his unit were soon pulled back into bivouacs for a break, but found themselves back in the fight again at the beginning of September as the New Zealand Division finally drove east of Bapaume. They were pushed forward to Havrincourt Wood, initially taking the western edge and driving forward until the Germans were seen pulling back and abandoning their defences within the wood. On the 22nd of September, Will's unit was in support as the Kiwis breached the St. Quentin Canal, one of a number of places that the Allies managed to break through the Hindenburg Line. From this point on, the Germans were in full retreat and the New Zealanders pursued them relentlessly. It was at this time that Will fell ill, struck down by the deadly flu, which was now blazing its way through the ranks of both opposing armies. Although suffering from a severe fever, he was able to be treated at the local field ambulance, avoiding the need for evacuation further back to hospital. Few could predict the toll the subsequent pandemic would extract when it reached New Zealand. Rejoining his unit on the 10th of October, just as they secured the high ground north of the town of Vizelay, Will was fortunate to have 12 days to further recuperate before the next major battle. He attacked with his battalion towards Bedenay on the morning of the 23rd of October, in a move which took the New Zealand Division to within reach of the fortress town of Le Quesnoy. After the Rifle Brigade had managed to secure the town in a surprise attack using scaling the walls with a ladder, Will's brigade pushed to the east in an assault on German positions in the Mormel Forest on the 5th of November. 28 were killed and 102 wounded in what would be their last action of the war. Withdrawn to Le Quesnoy for a break, Will and the 2nd New Zealand Infantry Brigade provided a guard of honour for the visit of Monsieur Poincaré, the President of the French Republic, on the 10th of November 1918. It was here that they learned of the armistice, which would come into force the following day. Will moved with the New Zealand Division into the western provinces of Germany, where they formed an Allied army of occupation. He remained there until March 1919, when he was withdrawn to the United Kingdom. Due to the large number of troops which needed transportation, it wasn't until 3 months later, in mid-June, that Will finally embarked for the voyage home. Arriving back in Wellington on the 24th of July 1919, Will spent another month in uniform before he was finally demobilised and discharged on termination of period engagement. He returned to Mangaroa in Napa Hutt before moving to Kaiparoro near Rekatahuna, where he worked on a farm. He later met Phoebe Gregg, who Will married in June 1923. They settled in Mangaroa Valley, raising 4 children, and had multiple grandchildren by the time they both passed away in the late 1960s. Phoebe was buried in Wallaceville Cemetery in January 1966 and was joined by her loving husband Will 2 years later in June 1968. Their headstone is a fitting tribute to this loving couple, but it gives no hint as to the brave military service and incredible story behind the epitaph. The cleaning of the grave provides a fitting tribute to a brave member of our local community. Thank you. that was from the Upper Hutt War Stories from the New Zealand Remembrance Army. Their research is freely available on their Facebook page, including service people's stories and their photographs. But sadly, that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests today, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hutt Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz, or check out my Facebook page for links to some of the individual interviews and stories, and my Facebook name is John McDonald NZ. If you have a suggestion of a Hutt story or a piece of music or poetry, then please do message us either on Facebook or email the team, and our email is thehuttzone@outlook.co.nz. Do join me again next Thursday in the Hutt Zone show. Until then, keep safe, and let's go out with some music from King Leo, supported and produced by Hutt Valley Talent. Here he is playing Lord, I Gotta Win One. Haere rā.
Killing themselves. Lord, I gotta win one. I'm about to lose my mind. Work myself to death. I wonder why I even try.
The program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.